Good morning. This remote meeting of the Climate and Energy Policy and Finance Committee is called to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Smaczynski.
Here.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bo.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Franson. Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippertz.
Lippert present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Mecklen.
Mecklen present.
Representative Munson is excused. Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
A quorum is present. Well, members, we have three bills up, but before we get to those bills, we are going to have a presentation on the Solar in Schools program. This was one of the great bipartisan successes of last year's omnibus bill. And there's been some discussion about potentially adding funding for community for solar on schools programs this year. And so we thought it would be helpful to get a status update for how the program's going. So first we will hear from Kevin Lee, our Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce. And congratulations on your new role, Kevin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long. And I appreciate you taking the time. I'm going to start. Got a few slides here to share with you, which I will get going. And I just want to double check that those slides have come through. Does that look all right?
They have. And if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself for the record.
Absolutely. So my name is Kevin Lee. I am the Deputy Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources at the Department of Commerce. And as you mentioned, Chair Long, this really has been an amazing bipartisan success. This is work that all preceded me. I recently joined the department a few weeks ago, but it's been very exciting and gratifying to see how it has developed. So we're excited to share a few of these updates with you. And with me today, I'm also joined by Commerce's Government Affairs Director, John Kelly, and our State Energy Office Director, Michelle Grancy. So to dig in a little bit here, as soon as I get the slides going, there we are. So the Department of Commerce administers the program that we're addressing here, the Outside Excel Energy Territory Program, which was established in Section 216C.375. This refers to areas that are primarily outside the Twin Cities metro area. It was developed with public input throughout the fall of 2021. And it was launched with the first request for proposals in January of this year. And the initial allocation was $7.2 million available for K through 12 schools and an additional $2.142 million for state colleges and universities. And so what this program does is it allows, it covers the cost for schools to install systems up to 40 kilowatts in size. And just so for a little bit of comparison's sake, to get a better idea of what that looks like, this is sort of the energy equivalent for that. If you imagine driving by a typical home that has a solar system on it, that would be, you know, somewhere in the 4 to 5 kilowatt range. So you can imagine from there what a 40 kilowatt system would look like. The other really interesting thing about this program is that by statute, schools are required to incorporate solar and renewable energy into their curriculum as part of these projects, which of course provides students really valuable hands-on experience in both clean energy jobs, and you know, producing energy on site. So to give you a little bit of a sense of how the program has developed, it was launched at the beginning of the year. We had a first round of what we called school readiness applications. that was open between January 5th and January 31st. These are the metrics, which I'll get into in just 1 second. And then we, once a school is deemed ready, they have until May 31st to submit a final application. So this two-part application was really, you know, the point of this is to assist schools in participating without making it an overwhelming, you know, administrative burden. So the applicants from the first round were notified February 28th of this year if they were selected to proceed. As I'm sure many of you know, this program was designed to allocate costs primarily to schools and school districts based on financial need for the K-12 schools that are eligible for funding. And so what Commerce staff did is with stakeholder feedback, they were really focused on making this process clear and making it transparent. And so we worked with a number of stakeholders and staff at the Department of Education from the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we reviewed some data from the Rural Educators Association and the Department of Education, which produced the metrics that you see here, which are a measure of essentially the financial need of a school district. These metrics are publicly available. They are, you know, known by school staff, and they're also posted online on our website. And so what you see, of course, is that toward the top, the more schools that have a higher financial need get more of the system cost covered, so up to 95%. And then you'll see that the dedication for colleges and universities is at 40%. And so what's been really exciting about this is getting a look at the applications that have come in. So we have received $12 million in grant applications. That represents 45 school districts and a total of 122 grant applications. The average request for these initial applications was 96,000. And so what that means is that we really are seeing applications from the schools that have the highest need. These are schools that would not otherwise be able to, or would be the least likely to be able to install these systems were it not for this program. So that's been really exciting and gratifying to see. This is some really tangible real world impact. So we have so far approved 80 schools to submit the final application by May 31st, which would represent a total grant expenditure of $7.5 million, which would fully exhaust the existing budgets, assuming that all of those schools submit final applications by May 31st. So what you're seeing here is a map of the school districts that have submitted applications. They are fairly spread out throughout the state, and again, largely out in greater Minnesota outside the metro area. Just for comparison's sake, prior to this program, there were roughly 60 school districts that had solar. So you take an additional 45 from this program, and you are, you know, virtually doubling the number of school systems that have solar energy installations installed. The number of students that this represents in terms of being exposed to this additional curriculum is roughly 160,000. So again, some really exciting on the ground impact. So because there is still remaining funding for state colleges and universities, we do plan on launching a July 1st request for proposals with a particular emphasis on state colleges and universities. We will also be conducting an update webinar for interested individuals statewide. And allowing for another stakeholder comment period before that launch. Finally, I will mention that if you'd like to be kept up to date, the website is mn.gov/solar4schools, with the number 4, of course. And I will also mention that the governor's budget includes a $3 million request for additional funding for this extremely successful program. And with that, myself and my staff are available for any questions, and we appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Deputy Commissioner Lee. And next we will hear from Rick Evans with Xcel Energy to talk about the Xcel-specific solar on schools program. Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy approaches solar on schools a little bit differently than the Department of Commerce has done in the rest of the state for a fairly simple reason. We have two programs currently going on that assist schools in putting solar on schools. One is our Solar Rewards Program, which is available to all of our customers, including schools. And the other is the PV Demand Credit, which is an Xcel exclusively available in Xcel Energy Service territory and helps schools buy down the cost. In addition, it doesn't exist anymore, but we had the Made in Minnesota program, which was exclusively in Xcel Energy Service territory. And the Made in Minnesota program also provided programs that allowed schools to put solar on their buildings. And as a result of those three programs, we now have 179 schools in our service territory that have installed solar on their roofs or on their property, consistent with the goals of the bill or the laws we're talking about today. I will add that the Solar Rewards Program that we've been running for several years now also has a low-income component to help provide additional assistance for our low-income customers to put solar on schools. And that program has been adapted to help schools that have a high rate of low-income students in their school districts, and those are included in the 179 schools that currently have the program. So we are in the process of launching our fourth program, which was the result of Representative Akam's bill last year, and that's the Solar on Schools program that is in Xcel Energy territory, sort of parallel with what the Department of Commerce was just talking about. Our program is a little bit different. We provide an upfront payment to schools to help them put the solar on their schools, but we also provide a production incentive. Which means that as your solar system produces energy, you get additional incentive from our program. This rises out of our experience with the Solar Rewards Program, which originally was an upfront program where we paid for the system upfront. And what we believe is that by providing a production incentive, it provides a strong incentive for both the installer, the developer of the system, as well as the school to keep their system in good repair, to keep their system operating as efficiently as possible. And so we're a strong believer in the production incentive program, and that will be part of our Solar on Schools program when it's put together. That was part of the discussion that was had last year on Representative Akam's bill. There are some solar developers and others who prefer, as we do, the production incentive program, and so that will be part of our program. We also will have an income qualified element to our solar on schools program, and while the production incentive for those schools will be the same, it will actually increase the amount that we pay up front to help them install solar. The other difference in Minnesota, or rather in Xcel Energy's program, is that after we reached agreement with the department on what our program should look like, we were required to submit it to the Public Utilities Commission to get our tariff approved. And of course, the Public Utilities Commission is a public process, and we have had, I believe, two parties submit concerns in the Public Utilities Commission process. One of those, I think, we've resolved with the party. The other one just came in last week. And so the implementation of our program has been delayed somewhat by the fact that we go through the Public Utilities Commission process. We think that's not all bad. It gives the public another opportunity to look at our program and make sure that it's conforming with what the public wants. And so while it's caused a little bit of delay in getting the program implemented, we think the program will be successful and perhaps improved by the fact that it's had one more look from the Public Utilities Commission. So we expect that to eventually, within the next few months, get worked through the PUC process and then the program will be fully approved and we will start offering it to our customers. Of course, in the meantime, schools still have the Solar Rewards program and the PV demand credit program available to them to help them if they're in a hurry. On the question that the chair raised at the beginning of the hearing in terms of additional funding, of course, I think it would be prudent to wait until we have the program up and running and perhaps look at that next year after we've got some experience. As I mentioned, we have 179 schools in our service territory that have used our programs to install solar. So one would expect the demand to perhaps be a little bit softer here in XL service territory compared to the rest of the state. And it would probably be wise to wait a year and see what our experience is with what will then be three programs offering help to schools but before we make a decision about increased funding. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. And I just wanted to start by thanking XL for working with the stakeholders to reach agreement on at least the first issue you raised. I appreciate collaboration and teamwork when we can find it. And so I appreciate those efforts. First question comes from the author of Solar on Schools, Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to XL and to the Department of Commerce. I remember meetings several years ago with representatives from XL and Michelle Grancy and others from both XL and Commerce. And so I thank you for your hard work. I know this has been not a straight line in getting to here, but I think that what we're seeing happen in the Department of Commerce with the application process is that it was that it is a valued program and will be well received. And so I just have a couple of questions. One for Mr. Lee. You talked about how many applications. I think you said you're funding 80 applications at 45 districts. How many total applications did you get? And just to better understand kind of what the initial ask was.
Deputy Commissioner Lee.
Sure, Representative Acom, members of the committee. So we received a total of 122 grant applications initially. And so of that, 80 schools have been notified that they, can proceed to the second stage of submitting final applications for May 31st.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you also talked about kind of the second application period. And I think you said you would also have an update webinar that would be available for schools that are interested. Is that with trying to encourage future interest for future potential applications?
Deputy Commissioner Lee.
Representative Acom, members of the committee. That's a great question. I am joined by the Michelle Grancy, who may have a clearer answer to that question. That's a great question. Michelle,
Deputy Commissioner Grancy.
Representative Long, Representative Acom. For the record, I'm Michelle Grancy. I serve as the director of the State Energy Office. And yes, the intent of constant stakeholder engagement is for evolution of the program. We recognize that in the first application period, it was solely K-12 schools that applied. So part of the intent of the webinar and feedback sessions is to better understand the needs of the state colleges and universities outside of XL territory and see if any program modifications might be needed in order to encourage applications there.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Ms. Grancy, that's very helpful. And then I just had, I wanted to thank Mr. Evans with XL for their hard work over the last couple of months with getting the XL program up and running. I'm getting calls and emails from schools in my district and around through the XL territory. There certainly is an interest to be able to apply and they're waiting patiently. I'm disappointed to hear about the second objection, and I certainly understand and appreciate that those things happen. And I think you said a couple of months. Maybe just give me a little bit more information about when schools can expect to get involved with the XL territory program.
Mr. Evans.
Sure. Unfortunately, I don't have a very good answer for you. The last concern that was raised was actually filed you know, either on or perhaps even a little after the deadline for comment from the public. So, and it was, I haven't read it in detail, I'll have to tell you, but it was a fairly broad objection without a lot of specifics. The first objection we had, I think there were some specific issues that we were able to work out with the party. This one is actually not from a solar developer, which the first one was. It's from a bunch of groups that have a concern about the program. So we haven't really had a chance to engage with them and see if there's changes that can be made to the program to accommodate their concerns. The concerns are, I don't want to, you know, they're trying to do the right thing, but they might be a little vague. It might be a little hard for us to understand exactly what it is they're concerned about. And then, of course, you know, if we aren't able to resolve it, then I suppose there's some sort of PUC action that would have to be taken, and they have very busy dockets too. So, you know, we're working as hard as we can, and we want to, you know, this, since the deadline has passed, presumably this will be the last concern we have to deal with. And, you know, I'm hoping it won't be very long, but I'm afraid I can't give you a very certain outlook.
Representative Aiken.
Just one final note of appreciation to XL. I know with the initial objection, you certainly went above and beyond to work through that. And so I appreciate that. This has been a long road, but I'm grateful to everybody for their hard work on it. And I do think it's a worthwhile and important program. So thanks for the update today.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my question, I think, is for Rick Evans, and appreciate your past participation and testimony. You know, in the rural co-ops, if memory serves me, a few years ago, we passed a law that with the reduction of electricity for people with solar, the co-ops did have the right, if I remember right, to charge an additional fee for the maintenance of the grid to the solar projects that were on their customers' farms or residents. Is there, when we put solar on the schools, obviously there's less XL or who's ever providing the electricity can charge because of the savings, but the grid has to be maintained, which means that if somebody's got to pay for that, and it's going to be the rest of the ratepayers. So is there a provision in solar on this for the schools where the provider of electricity can charge a fee for helping to maintain the grid? Rick, Mr. Evans.
Representative Grunhagen, if your question is to the rural co-ops, that's the program run by the Department of Commerce. So I'll direct that to Deputy Commissioner Lee.
No, it's not about rural. It's about the solar on the schools. Are the people providing the electricity to the school able charge a fee to maintain the grid?
Right, but I don't believe your question is regarding XL customers. It's regarding rural electric cooperatives. So that's the program run by the Department of Commerce. Deputy Commissioner Lee.
Representative Grunhagen, members of the committee, I don't believe that the statute contains a provision such as that. I know that the issue you're raising lives across a number of dockets that are currently pending before the PUC and a few other entities. But I do not believe that it's directly addressed by this program, no.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, so the result is, and I think members need to realize this, that there is savings for the school, and I appreciate that. I was on the school board for 16 years. So, but the grid has to be maintained, which means that all other ratepayers have to see an increase in their rates to maintain the grid. I would like to ask one question, a follow-up question to Mr. Evans. You know, you read article after article about the need, the critical need of upgrading our grid. I just wanted to see, as far as XL Energy is concerned, what's the state of the grid in Minnesota, and do we need critical updates in it to maintain reliability and security?
We did have a whole hearing on that, Representative Grunhagen, but I'll let Mr. Evans respond briefly before we move on.
You know, I think the best answer I can give is I don't know what you know, how everyone would define critical need, but the distribution grid and the transmission grid are in constant need of upgrading and improving because things are changing rapidly in terms of demand for energy and in terms of generation. So neither grid, the transmission nor the distribution grid, can be ignored. Ever.
Thank you, Mr. Evans.
Just one follow-up comment, Mr. Chair. I just think members need to realize somebody's got to pay for that. And if you don't have some type of chargeback from schools or businesses or residents that use solar and reduce the amount of electricity they use, the rest of the ratepayers have to pay higher rates to upgrade the grid. So I think that is a concern, and I think we should address it going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I'll just note one of the benefits of distributed generation is that it requires fewer grid updates because it's closer to load, and so you don't necessarily have to move it as far. So we're going to now take up our three bills. First, we will have Representative Bierman's House File 3905. Representative Bierman, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I care to move House File 3905, please, to be laid over.
Representative Bierman moves that House File 3905 be laid over for possible inclusion. And we did have a hearing on weatherization earlier. We're bringing the bill back because there's been some additional stakeholder engagement and some edits. And so I understand you have an author's amendment, coded DE5.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE5, please.
Representative Bierman moves the DE5. Would you care to explain your amendment?
Well, I think there's a lot of changes to the original. So
maybe we'll talk about that when we
get to the bill. Yeah, we can get to the bill after with questions, and we can go
okay,
through
any,
the changes.
Okay, any questions to the DE5 to get the bill in the shape Representative Bierman would like? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The DE5 is adopted. All right, Representative Bierman, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it was just a month ago we heard here in committee the full report on the work of the Department of Commerce Weatherization Task Force convened last fall. This report can serve as a guide moving forward. The long overdue need for expansion of our weatherization program across the state in every single county and district was highlighted at that hearing. As you recall, the Weatherization Assistance Program was begun in 1976 by the federal government. The objective, to assist low-income persons who have high energy burden. Priority is given to the elderly, persons with disabilities, and families with children. Two-thirds of the funding goes to rural areas of our state. Presently, as was heard a number of times, at the current pace of weatherization improvement, we have a nearly 300-year backlog of eligible homes across the counties of Minnesota in need of weatherization services. The bill before you today seeks to remedy this condition. We know what a robust weatherization program will do, and it bears repeating. It will create local jobs and economic activity in all our communities, lower utility bills by conserving energy, reduce stress on the power grid, increase energy equity, helping those Minnesotans most in need with the highest energy burden in all our districts, improving health and safety. We'll also reduce greenhouse gas emissions, make homes more resilient to the changes in our weather patterns. As the task force revealed, by all measures, we in Minnesota lag far behind our neighboring northern states in assisting those in need and our own economic well-being in regards to weatherization activity. We reach only 8 to 12% of the eligible applicants that do apply. And our deferral rate due to necessary remedial pre-weatherization activity is 50% of eligible residents in some counties. This bill, in brief, will utilize U.S. Department of Energy funding augmented by state dollars to expand the number of units receiving weatherization services with a focus on reducing the many deferrals across the state. The bill will address workforce training, expand outreach, and extend federal timelines for project completion. The Weatherization Assistance Program is a comprehensive, whole house approach that averages 20 to 30% energy reduction per unit. Weatherization provides a more permanent solution to energy burden. It is an upstream approach. And perhaps you recall that one of our service providers informed us that they have 9 residents receiving energy assistance payments for every 1 receiving weatherization work. In our last hearing also, I just wanted to mention there were questions about the integrity of the program, questions that should be asked. I hope the clear answers have laid those concerns to rest and that we may move forward to expand the model, increase production, and serve the people in all our districts who are most in need. So I'd like the committee to hear now from a local service provider, Mr. Scott Zahorek with the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, and then Mr. Bill Grant with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Please, Mr. Chair. And then we can go to member questions.
Sounds good. Mr. Zahorek, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the House of Representatives. My name is Scott Zahorek. I'm the Executive Director of the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, better known as AEOA, in Virginia, Minnesota. I come before you today to ask for your support for the low to moderate income households in Minnesota that we serve with the weatherization program. Our weatherization program serves St. Louis, Lake, and Cook counties, but we also partner with our neighbor to the west, Utaska Community Action, and our weatherization crews perform these same services for folks in Itasca and Couchiching County. And we also have longstanding related partnerships with our tribal neighbors, including the Grand Portage Band of Minnesota Chippewa, the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa, and the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Our inspectors and weatherization crews also provide services on tribal lands on behalf of the residents there as well. The weatherization program has been one of my favorite programs because the cost-effective one-time investments made in these homes become investments that benefit the families that live in the homes that will last a lifetime. Together, we represent the state that is home to the icebox of the nation, and the results we achieve couldn't be more important to the low-income families in Minnesota. The proposed measures that we do on each of the homes, we run through a software program that's been specifically designed for the program. If each individual measure cannot produce the required 5 to 20-year payback, depending on the measure type, we're not allowed to complete the measure. So these requirements assure that we're only making quality investments with the program funding that we know will achieve positive results for the families we are serving. We also provide health and safety measures that are in some cases critical to the health of the families that live there. In these times of extreme fuel costs, it's important to know, or it's more important than ever to ensure that the heating systems are running safely and at their peak efficiency. We also want to be sure that the thermal envelope of the home is at its best to keep that heat inside the home for as long as we possibly can. Your support for this program comes at a crucial time for the people we serve. With the anticipation of additional funding, it's now more important than ever that we reach out to all of the families that need our help, and we know that there are many families waiting to receive these services. Currently, we're forced to walk away from far too many homes that have certain pre-existing conditions, such as mixed light in their existing insulation, inaccessible crawl spaces, and homes that have active roof leaks. In our service area alone, the percentage of homes that we have to walk away from due to these conditions is 25%. In other areas of the state, the number is much higher. This proposed funding would help us to serve these families that need our help the most instead of leaving them confused as we're forced to walk away from them in their hour of need. An average home in our area spends about $2,000 a year to heat their home and another $1,000 for electricity. A recent study of the weatherization program showed that homes that receive these services can expect roughly a 28% savings on average in the reduction of their energy costs. So this would mean that an average home would save about $840 in annual energy savings. At first glance, that doesn't seem like a real staggering number, but when you consider a senior citizen on a fixed income living alone cannot have more than $35,236 in income a year, or a single mother raising two children can't have more than $56,920 in income per year. And many of the homes we serve, the folks in them are earning far less than that, but the amount of the savings really then takes on a new meaning. So as with many businesses across the state, we're currently struggling with hiring and retaining the quality staff we need to do our work. At AEOA, we use a crew-based operation for our weatherization work, as do several other agencies in Minnesota. This means that most of the workers on our projects are employees of AEOA. We do use independent contractors for the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing work that's needed, but in certain areas, that can also be a challenge to find those contractors. The rest of the agencies across the state use private contractors to perform the work for their programs, and like us, struggle to find contractors that will take the time to get the training and certifications they need to perform the work. I've been involved with the weatherization program for over 32 years and have heard from contractors many times that they cannot afford to take the time to attend any training without pay and instead need to go to work to earn a living. So this bill and the incentives it could provide would help us to change that and build a stronger workforce across the program. So as we hire our new employees, it's been a challenge for us to efficiently train our new staff to perform their duties for the projects in a timely manner. So to be considered for the position of an energy auditor, the program candidates must have prior construction background that can be verified. And then our new auditor candidates need to acquire the Building Performance Institute's Building Analyst Certification, which is a week-long training and then followed by a two-part test. Next, they need to be certified as a home energy professional. And to do that, that's also another week-long training and two-part test. They also have to complete a number of audits on homes on their own before they can achieve the certification. But the energy audits that we do on the homes, that it consists of collecting data on the home, conducting a variety of diagnostic testing on various components in the home. We do client education, site-specific energy modeling. And then once the job is finished and work is complete, we need to have a different inspector that is certified as a home energy professional quality control inspector to ensure that the work has been done properly and completely. Our staff do get a one-year grace period to get these certifications, but due to the high standards we have for the program, it usually takes more than a year for new staff to be acclimated and get comfortable with performing the audits on homes for the program on their own. One thing that would help is if we were able to create a training center that was available to both employees and contractors so that we could hold classes and provide the testing that we need for staff and contractors on a regular basis. It'd be a huge benefit to both the program and the participants and really help us with the production. Having trained staff and contractors across the state would also make a significant step in our ability to get an increased number of homes weatherized with this funding. The model for community action has long been helping people, changing lives. So today I ask that you help us to change the lives for low-income people in Minnesota. I'd also like to thank you for your time, energy, and interest in supporting the families across Minnesota that need our help the most. And I'd be happy to hopefully answer any additional questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zahorek, and thank you so much for the really important work you do.
Thank you.
Mr. Bill Grant, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bill Grant, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. The partnership represents 24 community action agencies that serve all 87 counties in Minnesota, and 19 of those agencies deliver weatherization assistance to eligible households throughout much of the state. I want to thank Representative Bierman for agreeing to author this critically important legislation. As you noted, Mr. Chairman, an earlier version of House File 3905 was heard by this committee on February 17th. Since then, we have been working diligently with stakeholders, including the building trades, state agencies, and clean energy and consumer advocates to address concerns with the bill. The result is the DE amendment that's in front of you today. Through the federal weatherization program, we have been weatherizing single-family homes and multifamily rental buildings since the late 1970s. But as Representative Bierman mentioned, at the current rate, it's going to take many decades to weatherize all of the income-eligible homes in the state. The bill in front of you today would allow us to accelerate that pace significantly by addressing the two major barriers to program achievement: severe workforce shortages and restrictive federal program rules. Section one of the bill identifies the purposes of supplementary state grants to weatherization service providers. These include the installation of pre-weatherization measures to address building deficiencies that otherwise prevent energy-saving measures from being installed in eligible homes, and expanded training opportunities for weatherization workers, including much-needed training facilities, since there is only one accredited training facility in Minnesota today. Federal program rules prevent expenditures on home repairs that must be completed before many homes can be weatherized. As Mr. Zahorek noted, up to half of the homes in otherwise eligible for services have to be deferred due to a number of pre-existing conditions. Supplemental and more flexible state funding provided for in Section 1 of the bill would be a bridge to the federal program by allowing necessary repairs to take place prior to implementing traditional weatherization services. Section 2 establishes the Weatherization Training Grant Program. Under this program, the Department of Commerce would award grants to nonprofits, labor organizations, job training, and educational institutions to train workers for careers in the weatherization industry. Grants would go to those entities capable of training to technical standards already established for the weatherization program. In order to complete weatherization work, auditors and inspectors must designate the work to be performed and inspect the work upon completion according to federal weatherization program standards. These standards are necessary to protect homeowners and renters and to assure high quality work. The weatherization training grant program in Section 2 of Representative Bierman's bill addresses the gap between available workers and the training they need to perform weatherization work. Section 3 makes a one-time appropriation from the Federal Fiscal Recovery Fund, otherwise known as the American Rescue Plan Act, for the purposes outlined in the first two sections. Weatherization saves consumers money on energy costs, reduces climate warming emissions otherwise released to heat homes, restores and increases the value of aging housing stock, and preserves affordable housing that is now in critically short supply. The investments outlined in Representative Bierman's bill will deliver great value to Minnesota taxpayers, communities, and those who struggle every day to make ends meet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to take the committee's questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Grant. And thank you, Representative Bierman, for all the important work over the last month to bring stakeholders together on a big and complicated problem. And I think this bill that we have here is a result of some really excellent engagement and consensus building. Representative Bolt.
Thank you, Chair Long. I think I've got two questions fairly quick, and they should be for the author. I'm involved in an organization called Christmas in May in Chaska that does, with volunteers, comes in and makes improvements in homes of folks, particularly those on fixed incomes. And I'm wondering if community organizations like Christmas in May would be available, would be allowed to receive funding through this to help purchase supplies and that sort of stuff when they're going in and doing weatherization work in older existing affordable housing stock.
Representative Bierman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the question, Representative Bo. You know, I think, as I understand it, it's a nonprofit.
It is. It is a nonprofit.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bo, if it's a nonprofit, I would think that that could certainly apply to Commerce for an application for funding for training of people to go in and do that work. And if training is needed, otherwise I would contact a local service provider to gain access to the program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably not training because it tends to be predominantly volunteer workforce, although there are some professionals from different trade unions that come in and help, but it's predominantly volunteers. So I would think the need financially for them would be supplies and equipment that they bring in to do the jobs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bo, I think just a funding for supplies, just only that, I don't think that that would necessarily apply. Perhaps Mr. Grant might have some input in how to handle such a local entity.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bo, in order to perform work under the program, the weatherization assistance program that we've been discussing, the entity would need to have trained staff that have been through the training program that we're outlining here or previously having done so. And it is the Department of Commerce that establishes contracts with weatherization service providers to conduct weatherization work around the state. So while I think it's fantastic that you have a local entity that is providing some of these services on a volunteer basis, I don't believe that that is necessarily comparable to the work being done under the Weatherization Assistance Program.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, it is unfortunate, but I appreciate the answer. My second question, if I may, I'm always on the lookout for unintended consequences that are produced by good intent. And so as I look at, in particular, the pre-weatherization measures, I wonder if the author sees, is there any danger that improvements like this could increase the property values enough that the homeowner on a fixed income might be no longer able to afford to stay in the house? That's something that I think about when I think outside the box.
Maybe Mr. Zahorek or Mr. Grant could speak to that. Mr. Zahorek?
Yeah, my comment on that would be most, we've had a number of cases over the years where people have thought things like this too, but typically with the insulating and air sealing that we do on the homes, you really don't see, you know, any physical sign of the improvements that are done because most of it is kind of behind the scenes, if you will. So I don't think there's any real big concern about increased property values. And if I may, Representative Bull, one comment that I would make to your earlier question is connect with your local community action agency. We work with all sorts of other entities trying to improve things because even with the resources we have, we can't address everything that needs to be addressed in the homes. And we've got partnerships with literally hundreds of other agencies and work together with them all the time. So thank you.
Good suggestion, Mrs. Zahor.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bo. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I get to my question, I'm going to address what Representative Bo just asked. I'm actually working on a bill in a different committee or a different process to eliminate a lot of what he just raised concerns for, because by simply putting in better windows, weatherization-wise, should not ever increase the value of your home. It's just making it better, as well as re-roofing and re-siding. However, as I read through this thing, especially the DE5, every year we're required to go to continuing education as a contractor, and 1 hour of that must contain energy efficiency and new things that came about the market. Would the educational providers that teach us our continuing education be eligible to teach this as well, like have a weatherization type class? Would they be eligible for it as well?
Mr. Grant?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mecklen, I believe if they've been through what the Federal Department of Energy requires as far as the training program and the work standards specifications required of the program federally, then they would be able to participate. Yes,
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll be more than happy to follow up with some of the different organizations I've taken my education through, because they often bring in very specialty individuals when it comes to energy efficiency and improvement. So I would think it would be very unfortunate if they weren't, as they see, you know, roughly, I don't know what it is now, 5,500 to 6,000 contractors each year. So it would be a great opportunity to promote this agenda that we're trying to do and get more homes more efficient. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good question, Representative Mecklen. I think we can probably follow up on that. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question to the folks. Is there so obviously we're trying to change the parameters on who would be eligible with this bill for their home to be weatherized for the pre-weatherization dollars. Is there currently a shortage of applicants under the current rules?
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, there is, I wouldn't say there's a shortage of applicants. I would, Representative Swazinski, I'd say that as was mentioned previously and in the task force report, if you take a look at it, we're the eligible applicants, you know, in every county of the state of Minnesota exceed the ability to supply the applicants with services by far. I mean, I mentioned there's only like an eight, we reach about 8 to 12% of applicants in the program now, thus the need to expand it. And within that, numerous ones are put on deferral because of they're not really ready for weatherization. They have these other issues that need to be addressed. So, this is there's a huge need for the program. There is a very large deferral rate, and those are two of the primary things we're trying to address with this bill.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I'm getting at. It seems like we're trying to expand the program, but we can't meet the current need of people that would actually apply under the current rules. So we're going to, you know, make the rules bigger so that more homes can get done, but we can't even fulfill the need for homes that would actually qualify. Am I correct?
Well, I think
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swazinski, first and foremost, we need to increase the funding to meet the current need. I would agree with that. We move to meet the current need, and then we're not so much the only really rules we're trying to address are working to make pre-weatherization possible so we don't have that delay once we go out and do have that audit done and inspection. If there are issues with pre-weatherization, it doesn't stop those people from getting the help that they need. We get it lined up so we get the pre-weatherization done and continue on with the project for that individual site. So, you know, there is a building process there, obviously, and trying to do more. But number one, first thing we need critically is the funding to be able to do that, the changing that application of rules to a permit with state dollars for the pre-weatherization side. And that will increase production. From there, we need to build the workforce to support that. So, like we said, there's a 300-year delay for where we're at today. Obviously, you know, we're not going to get to everybody in a year or two. So this is going to be something we need to build and sustain over the long haul.
And it's my understanding, too, this doesn't change income eligibility. We're just looking at doing additional pre-weatherization. So people who are eligible now but can't get services are able to. Representative Swazinski.
Could it be argued that this puts to disadvantage people that, you know, if we're to do this, because we'll always have limited money in this area, doesn't this put at a disadvantage if this moves forward, folks that would be, that are, let's say you got someone that just re-roofed their house. This would put them at a disadvantage to someone that hasn't done that to qualify for the weatherization.
Representative Bierman, that looks like Mr. Graham wanted to respond. Representative Bierman.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Grant, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Swetitzky. No, I don't believe that's the case. If a person has re-roofed their home recently and are otherwise eligible for the program, and that was the only deficiency that needed to be addressed, they could be then weatherized immediately. There wouldn't be the need then to find additional resources that this bill provides to conduct the pre-weatherization work.
Representative Swetitzky.
No, but wouldn't the normal path be, so let's say you went through the process, someone needs to re-roof their house in order to qualify. Wouldn't, let's say, the next person that would have maybe been denied because of a lack of funds that already did re-roof their house, they won't receive funds. I mean, essentially, when you say we have a 300-year wait, that's what we're doing, is we're saying if you've re-roofed your home, you go further back in the line to get weatherization. Because we're changing the rules for people that haven't, you know, put the money into their home.
Mr. Grant.
You get what I'm saying?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, no, I don't think that's accurate. The program uses a priority scheme that treats homes for elderly and disabled and those with young children as top priorities. So the fact that a person has invested in their home but is otherwise eligible doesn't change where they fall on the priority ranking.
Representative Swetitzky.
But wouldn't you be, like, let's say your home is not pre-weatherized up to the code. So, like, if you needed shingles, you haven't done it, does that person just, then it would go to someone else, correct? The money to do their home?
Mr. Grant, then looks like Mr. Zahorek wants to weigh in.
I'll defer to Mr. Zahorek.
Mr. Zahorek.
Thank you, Chair Long. Thank you, Representative Swetitzky. One thing I'd say with our process, with how we look at who is first with limited resources for the weatherization program, as Mr. Grant said, we look at the three priorities, elderly, handicapped, and children in the home. But there's a fourth priority that we go by as well, and that's their total energy consumption. And the piece I think that's missing in this conversation is, as we're looking for the houses that meet the other criteria and have the highest energy consumption, those become our primary targets. And for me, the issue with who we get to first is we really want to serve those households that have a high energy burden first, you know, regardless of some of these other circumstances. And the strength, I think, in this bill is it allows us to deal with some of those factors and weatherize those homes that really do need it the most that we've been walking away from to this point. You know, yes, there are a lot of homeowners out there that need help, but when we're looking at it from the energy perspective and going to the highest need first and then down the line, I think the combination of the existing program and this bill is a fantastic change that's really going to help the folks that need it most first. We'll get to, you know, people eventually, but this really helps us to make the biggest impact, and it's also going to have the most potential for energy savings as well. Thank you.
Last question, Representative Swetitzky, and then we'll have to move on to our next two bills.
Thank you. I appreciate everyone willing to hear me out on this. Just trying to get my head around it. So, essentially, let's say this moves forward. You have people that are high energy homes. How much will this add to the cost of the project? So let's say you're putting $4,000 into weatherization for a home, windows, insulation, obviously is more than that. As a percentage of higher cost, my guess is if you've got to do a new roof job is probably more expensive than an insulation job. So would you on average double the cost per cost? So like if an average project would be $8,000, if you allow for pre-weatherization, would that additional cost be up to $16,000 or $20,000? because you're additionally putting shingles on a home. And then, you know, we help elderly folks in nursing homes and stuff, and we oftentimes have an asset allocation. So when that family member passes along, the home would be sold, a percentage of that home value goes back to the state to help pay for their long-term care facility costs. Is there any thought that if we're going to be now improving the home on a drastic level when it comes to pre-weatherization, that the state would be able to, you know, keep a part of that asset since they're putting such a large, taxpayers are putting such a large amount of money into it, so that they could recoup some of those costs at the time of sale? Thanks.
Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the second part of your question, Representative, there isn't a provision for that in the bill, and that's never been a part of the federal program either. And perhaps you can remind me your first question briefly.
The total cost.
The total cost.
Total cost like per project. So like if you've got, you're just doing siding and windows, but now you're going to do shingling, my guess is you'd probably double the total cost of that project when it comes to the amount of grant necessary to get the whole thing done.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Swedinski, the cost will be dependent on what needs to be done in the home in order to make it ready for weatherization. Some of those costs could be higher depending on the need. As you say, a roof job might be more expensive than fixing an attic crawl space, which could be relatively economical, but is a measure that we currently can't address.
Mr. Zahoric, briefly, and then we'll have to wrap up this bill. Mr. Zahoric.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swedinski. One comment I'd like to make is we do at our agency have a variety of rehabilitation programs that can take on bigger projects in the homes. And if a house needed a complete roof or needed siding or windows, we typically look to those programs first to address those needs because they are big ticket items, usually above what the weatherization program can handle. So we would do a referral to the other programs, try and get those issues taken care of there. The more traditional type of work for the weatherization program of insulating and air sealing. And those rehab programs, they do put a lien on the property so that if people move or sell their home, that some of that money is recaptured. But the weatherization money, as Mr. Grant said, has never included those priorities. Thank you.
Mr. Zahoric. Representative Bierman, closing comments to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the good questions. Really appreciate the testifiers being here who are working in this issue every single day, and their discussion on some of the issues that members have brought up that are kind of outside the scope of this bill. But appreciate the comments and look forward to support moving forward. Thank you.
Representative Bierman renews his motion that House File 3905 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Next, we have Representative Lippert with House File 2624. Would you care to move your bill, Representative Lippert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2624 to be referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. I also have a DE amendment, Mr. Chair, and I can move that amendment.
Representative Lippert moves House File 2624 be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Lippert, please move your DE.
I move the DE amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lippert moves DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the DE1 is adopted. Representative Lippert, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Minnesota's Property Assessed Clean Energy, or PACE program, has provided low-cost financing for over 350 clean energy projects across the state, totaling over $225 million of investment. These projects stimulate private investment, improve cash flows, while reducing energy costs and environmental impacts. Currently, Minnesota farmers can only utilize PACE for energy projects such as installing solar panels. House File 2624 would expand the projects eligible for PACE financing to include water conservation projects and a broader set of high-quality, long-term improvements to farmland and commercial buildings. These projects could include drip irrigation systems, which are much more efficient, projects that hold water back on the landscape, allowing it to naturally infiltrate into the soil, fencing and water access for managed rotational grazing, natural landscape improvements for wildlife and pollinators, and permanent perennial crops. Just as the current PACE program applications go through an energy audit by a third party in order to be approved, these projects would go through an agronomic assessment by a third party. We define agronomic assessment as a study by an independent third party that assesses the environmental impacts of proposed land and water improvements on farmland. Projects will need to show a reduction in the environmental impact in addition to profitability for approval. Farmers are experiencing heavier rainfalls, drier droughts, and volatile temperatures. This bill aims to provide producers with additional financial tools for improving the resiliency of agricultural land while improving environmental outcomes at the same time. I have two testifiers with me, Mr. Chair, and the first is Pete Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority.
Mr. Klein, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Klein. I'm Vice President of Finance with the St. Paul Port Authority. And I'd like to thank Mr. Lippert, Representative Lippert, for authoring this bill. So years ago, the Department of Commerce asked the Port Authority to try to get PACE going in Minnesota. And I took a hard run at it, and it found out that it does have some really nice niches that it works very well with. The projects that have been accomplished rank us third in the nation behind California and Ohio. So we were recognized as the best program in the nation last year by the PACE Nation, the national organization group. We have joint powers agreements with about 70 of the 87 counties, and we are accomplishing projects all over the state, from a biotech manufacturer in Austin to hotel in International Falls, housing project in Laverne, a building panel manufacturer in Albertville, and a restaurant up in Ely, and numerous farm projects as well. So Cargill came to us and asked if PACE could be a funding mechanism for these agricultural land enhancements. And nationally, other states use PACE to finance other areas other than just energy. California uses PACE to fund seismic retrofits. Florida uses it to fund hurricane preparedness. Many of the newer states adopting PACE actually have included an R at the end of PACE, so it's PACER in those states, and R for resiliency. So I said we'd take a look at that, and we do think that there is environmental benefit that can be derived from these projects on agricultural facilities, and we could help Cargill reduce the environmental impact of its production network. So in addition to that, then most states, in fact, I think Minnesota is the only state that doesn't have water conservation as an eligible use for PACE, so we're asking to have water conservation be added as well. And really feel that these projects will have great environmental impact, increased profitability in these operations, and thank Representative Lippert for authoring this.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Representative Lippert, should I go ahead and introduce your, why don't you go ahead and
please introduce please do. Mr. Brad Jordahl Redland from the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program is here to testify as well.
Great, thank you. Mr. Jordahl Redland, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brad Jordahl Redland, employed at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, manager of the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. My comments will be pretty brief today. I just want to make a couple of points. That first point being that at the agency, we recognize that the proposed change here to the PACE program, the intent and goal is complementary to existing projects around agriculture conservation, water quality conservation, et cetera. While at the same time, it constitutes a unique mechanism that doesn't otherwise exist in the state and has value in those realms. A second point would be that MDA, of course, supports all arrays of efforts to enhance the conservation and production resiliency performance of agricultural lands. So we're interested anytime people are making proposals like that. And we appreciate the fact that that those types of enhancements to agricultural lands and operations have economic benefits as well, which leads to another point that we further appreciate that consistent with energy products where that third-party analysis assessment is taken to show that the energy, renewable energy benefits achieved through the retrofitting or the practice adoption will pay off, that this program for agriculture conservation activities also goes through an assessment to determine that there will be positive outcomes from the practices and implementation of the proposed activities that would presumably be obtaining funding. And we can speak in one particular sense through the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, where we find that we do assess farms for their conservation opportunities. And those farms who do become certified, we have seen through independent analysis by the Farm Business Management Program at the Minnesota State Colleges that water quality certified farms have a 20% higher net income on average than those non-certified. So we see that conservation is a payoff in agriculture. It provides that added resiliency and production opportunity for growers. So that will conclude my comments. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Giving a minute to see if there's any questions from members. Seeing none, Representative Lippert, would you care to make closing comments to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time. I think this is just it's a helpful tool to have in the toolbox for producers that'll help with resiliency in the face of increasing impacts from climate change and support more profitability over time, too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Representative Lippert renews his motion that House File 2624, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Aye.
Vice Chair Akam.
Aye.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Bo.
Call me back. Aye.
Could you repeat that? My apologies, Representative Bo.
Bo votes aye.
Thank you. Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein aye.
Representative Igo.
Igo no.
Representative Lee.
Lee aye.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert aye.
Representative Lislegarde.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen?
No.
Representative Munson is excused. Representative Stevenson?
Aye.
Christensen? Aye.
Christensen, aye.
So we have 11 ayes and 5 nays. Bill passes and is re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Thank you, Representative Lippert. Our final bill up today is House File 1289. Representative Hollins, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move my bill, please.
Representative Hollins moves that House File 1289 be laid over for possible inclusion. And my understanding is you have a DE. Would you like to move your DE as well?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the DE, please.
Okay. Representative Hollins moves the DE1 to get the bill in the shape she would like. Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. So House File 1289 is the intervener compensation bill that we heard last session. As you may recall, this bill expands the opportunity for public representation at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission by allowing cost compensation for Minnesota nonprofits, tribal governments, and residents engaged in PUC proceedings. Participation in the PUC dockets is very resource intensive, and those costs can exclude, end up excluding public interest advocates. While utility companies recover the cost from ratepayers by presenting for presenting their desired outcome, there's currently no compensation method for participation by non-governmental organizations who represent ratepayer interests. And as a quasi-judicial agency, the evidence offered in PUC proceedings needs to be developed based on substantial arguments. To effectively represent constituents in those proceedings, public interest organizations need to advance positions based on commission precedent, administrative rules, and statutes. In order to develop a comprehensive record inclusive of low-income households, residential customers, and other public interests, it is essential that the commission consider a range of perspectives and expertise. This bill really promotes equitable access to the PUC's process for establishing utility rates and energy-related practices and policies, and it ensures that financial resources are available on behalf of underrepresented communities and constituencies. So I have a couple of testifiers here to speak on the specifics of the bill language and how it's kind of changed from the initial time I introduced it last session. So I'll turn it over to them.
All right. First, we have Annie Levinson-Falk, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota utility consumers. Thank you for taking up this bill and for the opportunity to speak on it today. CUB and the Energy Sense Coalition, you'll hear from Pam Marshall after me. We've been working on this bill for more than a year to update the intervener compensation statute, which, as Representative Holland said, allows certain groups that participate in PUC dockets related to public utilities to have their costs reimbursed in certain cases. And the purpose of that statute is to get better representation of the public interest at the PUC. The PUC is only allowed to consider evidence that's been put on the record in each docket that it takes up, which means that it depends on the parties to bring that kind of evidence in a way that's representative of the variety of all the considerations that they have to weigh. But it's really difficult to participate at the PUC, and especially to bring the kind of depth of analysis that's needed in order to actually do a good job and to be successful. I come from a ratepayer perspective, and ratepayer interests are too rarely well represented in PUC dockets. This bill isn't going to overcome the resource imbalance that ratepayers face, of course, but it will help. Currently, the law allows for public interest interveners to have their cost of participation reimbursed in general rate cases up to $50,000 per case. And general rate cases are very important, but they only happen periodically. For example, Xcel is going through its first electric rate case in 7 years and its first natural gas rate case in more than a decade right now. Utility charges are frequently increased without rate cases and other kinds of dockets, of course. And there are other dockets that deal with service standards, shutoffs, low-income assistance programs, and many other important issues. And none of those kinds of dockets are covered by the intervener compensation statute right now. Briefly, here's what the bill does. It allows compensation to be granted to qualifying participants in proceedings regarding investor-owned electric and natural gas utilities. Qualifying participants include Minnesota nonprofits that face a financial hardship, tribes, or individuals whose participation advances a public purpose. It limits the amount of compensation that can be granted to any group and the total amount that any utility can be required to pay so that it represents a very nominal amount that's included in utility rates. And it raises the bar that parties have to meet in order to qualify for this kind of compensation, so that it's only available to groups who provide work that's unique and that's reflected in the commission's written order at the end of a proceeding. Over the last session, we spent a lot of time working with utilities, the Department of Commerce, House members, and particularly with members of the Senate Energy Committee who raised concerns. We took those concerns to heart and went back to the bill to address them, which is the basis of the DE that you had adopted today. And they made a number of changes, but I want to highlight six that I think are particularly substantive. As I said, nonprofits can now only qualify if they demonstrate financial hardship, and that means that larger, well-funded organizations don't qualify for compensation. The maximum amount of compensation that can be awarded to a single group in any docket has been lowered. the maximum total compensation that can be awarded to any group in a year has been lowered, and the maximum amount of total compensation that any utility can be required to provide has also been lowered. A loophole that the Senate identified that could have allowed for double compensation in a docket that stretched over two calendar years has been eliminated. And there's now a report back to the legislature after 3 years. Under the amended caps in the bill, even if compensation is absolutely maxed out, which I think is unlikely because of the other caps and the strict qualifications that a participant must meet, but say that compensation does get to its absolute maximum, it can't add more than about 0.04% to any utilities collections. That's a strict limit that's in the law and couldn't be flexed no matter how many organizations request compensation. Helping ratepayer advocates be in more dockets will save money many times that amount. In conversations that I've been having with the bill or about the bill, I've been asked to share some examples of how this kind of intervention saves ratepayers money. And so I thought it might be helpful to share a few examples here today. So I have a few examples that are just from CUB's work over the past year. One is that CUB is currently recommending that utilities be denied the ability to charge their customers $158 million. For money that was spent on natural gas during the price spike caused by the February 2021 winter storm. CUB argues that Xcel, CenterPoint, and Minnesota Resources could and should have done more to reduce costs, and they didn't because they believed that ratepayers would cover it all. This proceeding is currently before an administrative law judge, and the PUC is expected to make a decision on it this summer. Another example is an estimated $29 million that was saved for Minnesota power customers last year. After the economy slumped in 2020 and large industry didn't buy as much power as projected, Minnesota Power turned to its other ratepayers to make up its lost revenues. CUB and others argued that it's not ratepayers' job to guarantee a private company's revenues, and the request was denied. And third, and is an example that we actually did in cooperation with the utility, working with Minnesota Power to reduce its interim rate increase by half recently. Interim rates are charged on customers' bills while a general rate increase that a utility has requested is under consideration. Last year, the Energy Stats Coalition and CUB worked together with Minnesota Power to cut their residential interim rate increase from 14% to 7%. So those are a few examples from CUB's recent work, but of course, intervener compensation would be available to any group that meets the standards in the bill. And finally, just an update on where this bill stands in the other body. So the Senate Energy Committee held a favorable hearing on it last week, and it has a support from majority of committee members in the Senate this year. This bill is the result of a lot of hard work among stakeholders and legislators from both parties in both chambers. I thank you for the opportunity to speak on it today and would be happy to address any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you so much. And next we will hear from Pam Marshall, and we have about 8 minutes left, so if we can try to make sure we have some time for questions as well. Ms. Marshall, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Pam Marshall, and for the last 30 years, I've served as the Executive Director of the Energy Sense Coalition. Our organization promotes affordable utility service for low and fixed income Minnesotans through our participation in PUC proceedings, policy advocacy, and the administration of utility bill payment and conservation assistance programs. We support this bill because some of the most time-consuming commission dockets involve stakeholder processes that work toward consensus positions on a range of issues. The reliance upon these stakeholder engagements has increased a lot since I began this work in 1992. And I think that that shift represents a positive change because these more intensive conversations with companies, state agencies, and other advocates lead to a better understanding of parties' respective positions and by extension to better public policy outcomes. Investing this time also means that parties can offer more deliberate and constructive proposals for the commission's consideration. At the same time, there's still a bit of a David and Goliath dynamic when it comes to PUC proceedings, not just between the utility companies and advocates, but also between smaller and larger public interest organizations. Larger organizations with more funding can simply participate in more proceedings, and low-income energy consumer representation is not always as robust. Energy Sense is often confronted with responding to multiple parties in any given proceeding. Our years of advocacy for affordable residential utility rates, our work to design and implement utility assistance programs for thousands of energy burdened residents throughout the state can't always be offered in those relevant dockets. In that absence, important knowledge and perspectives based on that knowledge can get lost. If, however, we were able to earn compensation under the terms contemplated by this bill, we would not always have to limit our representation of low-income people to the extent we do now. If some of our participation was compensated, we may be able to expand policy staff so a low-income utility perspective could be offered in more dockets. For example, because of our workload and limited resources, we had to choose to stay out of the current CenterPoint rate case, even though our participation in past rate cases resulted in lower rates for lower usage customers. And in another case, the first low-income conservation improvement program dedicated exclusively to low-income renters in 1-4 unit homes. We also declined to participate in the gas price spike investigation that Ms. Levinson-Falk referenced, even though before it was referred to an administrative law judge, we worked with parties to exclude energy assistance recipients and certain past due customers from any surcharge associated with those price spikes. About $25 million of the surcharge, therefore, across the natural gas utilities was not imposed on those customers already struggling to pay for their natural gas bills. A couple of examples about where we could be compensated that we are not compensated now. We worked during the governor's COVID emergency declaration with all of the regulated utilities to develop a residential customer status report, which provided accessible and standardized public information about the number of service disconnections, the number of past due customers, payment agreement terms, and annual indicators to gauge the effect of the pandemic on residential customers' ability to pay for this basic need. These reports, we're urging the commission now to continue requiring the IOUs to provide that information. And these reports are important because they can signal, for example, the need to respond to worsening customer past due utility bills or service disconnection trends and to target resources to mitigate those trends. None of this work was compensated, but would have been if this bill was passed. In interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'll skip my other example. It had to do with Minnesota Power's residential rate transition from flat rates to a time of day. It was an important stakeholder process because we reached a consensus position that advanced both Minnesota's renewable energy goals, but also made rates affordable in the interim. We're simply asking you to support this bill so we can continue to participate in PUC proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Marshall. I'm not seeing member hands. I just want to thank Ms. Levinson-Falk and Ms. Marshall for giving really good examples of the type of work that could be done by this funding. And I think it would be a small investment to save some large money over the long run for Minnesota ratepayers. And so appreciate your collaborative efforts to try to bring this bill into a place where there's consensus around it. Representative Hollins, you want to make some closing remarks in our final minute?
I would just like to say thank you so much to Annie and Pam for all of their hard work on this. And thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. I think it is a common sense, well thought out, well negotiated piece of legislation. And I'm really excited to carry it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 1289 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Members, that's our business for today, and we are adjourned.